From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile. As Israel intensifies its military occupation of the Palestinian territories in the wake of the attacks on the U.S., an exclusive interview with Professor Edward Said. And the UN warns of a humanitarian catastrophe in Afghanistan. Up to 1 million Afghans could face starvation as Bush officials prepare to bomb them. We'll go to Islamabad and Peshawar. All that and more coming up on the War and Peace Report. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. A group of Norwegian academics say that President George Bush should be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize if he manages to catch those responsible for the attacks on the U.S. without sparking a war and causing further loss of innocent lives. The 12 university professors and other intellectuals nominated Bush in a Norwegian daily. They said their pacifist proposal was aimed to make the world think about ways of solving conflict without escalation of violence. President Bush launched a financial offensive against Osama bin Laden yesterday, freezing the assets of the Saudi Exiles Organization and its sympathizers while threatening foreign banks with the same treatment if they fail to cooperate with the U.S. initiative. The order froze the assets of 27 individuals and organizations suspected of links with bin Laden's al-Qaeda and other networks. It went further than a similar order issued by the Clinton administration, expanding the category of targeted groups to include all those, quote, associated with designated terrorist groups. The order also gave the Treasury Department the authority to freeze the U.S. assets and transactions of foreign banks which did not cooperate with the U.S. President Bush made it clear that European banks could be targeted and said he recognized the countries concerned might have to rewrite their laws to meet U.S. demands. President Bush yesterday backed off the administration's pledge to quickly release evidence against Osama bin Laden. He said doing so could, quote, make the war more difficult to win. Secretary of State General Colin Powell, standing at Bush's side, sent an entirely different signal a day earlier when he said the administration in the near future would be able to release a document that will describe clearly the evidence. The ruling Taliban in Afghanistan has said it would hand over Osama bin Laden if the U.S. presented credible evidence of his guilt. Other countries have also urged the U.S. to use legal mechanisms in its quest for justice rather than military force. Saudi Arabia cut all ties with Afghanistan's Taliban government today, saying Afghan leaders were defaming Islam by harboring and supporting terrorists. The move by one of the most influential nations in the Islamic world marks a major step forward for the United States in its effort to put pressure on and isolate the Taliban. Under intense U.S. lobbying, the United Arab Emirates shut the Afghan embassy in Dubai and severed ties with the Taliban on Saturday, leaving Pakistan the only country to maintain diplomatic relations with the Taliban. Bin Laden's al-Qaeda organization, meanwhile, issued a fiery new statement today warning Washington against attacks against either or Afghanistan. The statement read, "Wherever there are Americans and Jews, they will be targeted. We can defend ourselves. The holy warriors are fully prepared." The World Health Organization warned yesterday that new advances in technology have made it possible for terrorists to kill millions of people with chemical or biological weapons. The draft 179-page report was rushed out after calls for advice on how to combat germ warfare. World Health Organization released the report as it emerged that an order would be issued in the U.S. today grounding all crop dusting planes amid fears that those behind the September 11th attacks may have been plotting to use the aircraft to spray chemical or biological weapons. The nation's largest commercial pilots union said yesterday it'll seek support from Congress to arm pilots as a last line of defense against hijackers. The extraordinary proposal came as lawmakers in the Bush administration accelerate efforts to draft plans for expanding airport and airline security in the wake of the September 11th hijackings. A union spokesperson said this is a radical change for airline pilots, but it's an indication of the threat. He said the union envisioned a voluntary program run by federal law enforcement. Again, Maine U.S. Pilots Union wants members, the pilots, to carry guns. The House yesterday unanimously approved legislation that would provide $582 million to pay back dues to the United Nations, a reflection of how the political landscape has been altered by the attacks 2 weeks ago. For months, conservatives have blocked the payment of the UN arrears. During a brief floor debate yesterday afternoon, followed by a voice vote, both Republicans and Democrats said the United States cannot afford to ignore the UN's needs at a time when Bush administration officials are seeking a broad international coalition to support U.S. military strikes against Afghanistan. White House officials have lobbied behind the scenes for the money since the attacks. And the Bush administration's urgent quest for new anti-terrorism laws bogged down in Congress yesterday as lawmakers from both parties expressed concern that the hastily prepared package could greatly expand police powers at the expense of privacy and other civil liberties. At a meeting of the House Judiciary Committee, skeptical members confronted Attorney General John Ashcroft and other senior Justice Department officials on a number of administration proposals, including one that would permit the indefinite detention without trial of immigrants suspected of ties to terrorist groups. They also said the administration is trying to force the package through Congress without giving lawmakers time to adequately digest proposals that could have serious unforeseen consequences for rights that Americans now take for granted. Right-wing Congressmember Bob Barr, the conservative Georgia Republican, asked, "Why is it necessary to rush this through? Does it have anything to do with the fact that the department has sought many of these authorities on numerous other occasions, has been unsuccessful in obtaining them, and now seeks to take advantage of what is obviously an emergency situation to obtain authorities that it has been unable to obtain previously?" At the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, meanwhile, Ashcroft's proposed expansion of a provision of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which governs wiretapping of non-Americans inside the United States, ran into trouble not only with Democrats and civil liberties advocates, but also with at least one Republican member of Congress. Stop the War Now, Edwin Starr, here on Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from where the World Trade Center towers once stood. And today, the smell outside is particularly acrid as we continue to be inside the evacuation zone where hundreds of emergency workers continue to take away rubble, and yet no survivors have been found in many days. Since the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, political commentators have flooded the mainstream media with superficial commentary about the nature of Islam, its relation to the Taliban, and the challenges the U.S. faces in being understood and appreciated in the Muslim and Arab world. The Bush administration is continuing in its efforts to convince Arab and Muslim states to support its plans for wide-ranging military action against the Taliban, using a combination of threats, diplomacy, and the lure of military and economic aid. But there's still little reflection on the social, political, and economic basis of the resentment that U.S. power has engendered, not just in the Middle East and Central Asia, but around the world. There's been even less discussion of what a just relationship with Arab and Muslim states might look like, or how the U.S. might get there, ideas that seem lost in the Bush administration's single-minded preparation for a war we still know almost nothing about. We're joined on the telephone right now by Edward Said. He's a professor of comparative literature at Columbia University, an author of many books, including Orientalism, The Culture of Imperialism, and his memoir, Time Out of Place. He is also considered a leading voice for Palestinian self-determination. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Professor Said.
Thank you, Amy.
Thomas Friedman writes in his column in today's New York Times, quote, "I understand that this particular act of terrorism we just experienced is something so much more frightening than what Beirut's residents had to deal with." He ends his column with the reflection, "I went to the ball game Friday night, took in Dvorak's New World Symphony at the Kennedy Center Saturday, took my girls out to breakfast in Washington Sunday morning, then flew to the University of Michigan. Heck, I even went out yesterday and bought some stock. What a great country. I wonder what Osama bin Laden did in his cave in Afghanistan yesterday." Professor Said, can you comment, help us unpack some of the assumptions in these words?
Well, I think in the first place, speaking as a New Yorker and somebody who's lived here really the major part of his life, I mean, I'm second to none in feelings of horror and sorrow and disorientation as a result of what happened. But there's no need, I think, to take us out of history and out of time and turn the agony of New York into sort of a unique event of all time. I'm a man of two worlds, really. I mean, my entire family went through the siege of Beirut by the Israeli army, when in the course of 3 months, 20,000 people in a country of roughly 2.5 million people were killed by the Israeli army, basically people living with no protection, no anti-aircraft guns, no missiles, nothing to protect the onslaught of Israeli F-15s and helicopter gunships and missiles and rockets and all the rest of it. So, you know, sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. I mean, we're suffering under such horror is equal, it seems to me, in every part of the world. And what is implicit in a lot of what Friedman writes is that the Arabs and Muslims are to be talked down to, that somehow their experiences are not as valid or somehow not as valuable as those of the so-called West. I mean, I say so-called because the West is really a very nebulous idea. Most Lebanese think of themselves perhaps as part of the West. So, you know, it's difficult to make, to draw distinctions of this sort. The other is that the experiences, much as one hates them and despises them, the experiences that produce the kind of mad mindset of which Osama bin Laden has become the embodiment are the tip of the iceberg. I myself don't understand what would drive a person to suicide and to the kind of mass murder that these bombers did on September the 11th. But certainly the feeling of resentment and human dismissal, which a lot of people in the Arab and Islamic world feel, is very, very real. Not because of some fantasy about America. Most of them, in fact, are very interested in and fascinated and indeed like America. Their children coming. I'm talking now about the intellectuals, of whom, of course, Osama and his people are examples. They're not wretched of the earth. They're not people who live in a refugee camp. These are educated, middle-class people who have gone bananas as a result of the tremendous pressure on their minds of what they perceive as American contempt and dismissal of them as human beings, their religion, their culture. It's very difficult for a Muslim today in Pakistan or in Saudi Arabia or in Egypt not to make connections between the agonies of Chechnya, the agonies of the Palestinians, the contempt with which Islam is regularly discussed and treated in the media, the way in which the United States has, for the last 10 years, more or less single-handedly been inflicting a regime of horrendous genocidal sanctions against the people of Iraq, and to see all of this as a product of one power which can get away with it, and when the disaster strikes, as it did last week, horribly, maleficently, in the worst and most barbaric way, of course, to see this as a kind of retribution and to see it as a kind of, you know, sort of just desserts and not feel the kind of compassion and fellow suffering that most people would ordinarily feel. Partly, they think, because none of that compassion and fellow feeling and fellow suffering has been manifested toward them. They've been treated as the enemy. The United States supports regimes like that of Saudi Arabia, for example, or the Israeli government, you know, because it suits them, not because it's a humane support or support for humane purposes. And in this mind, which we have no inkling of, there's very little interchange on any level at all, really. The connections are made and ascriptions are made for which there's very little contradiction, but simply because the Arab and Islamic world are treated with the kind of contempt and inferiority that we feel they deserve. It's mostly ignorance, I think, a terrible, terrible ignorance, the result of poor education in our part of the world and poor education in their part of the world.
We're talking to Professor Edward Said of Columbia University. Others, as well as Friedman of the New York Times, write of the Taliban in particular and the Muslim world in general as being anti-modern, jealous of American technology, and attacking the United States for its freedom.
Well, this is one of the most monstrous ideological fictions I've ever heard. It was originally started around the time, I mean, and gained currency around the time of Huntington's article on the Clash of Civilizations, and it comes from the work of several very, very reactionary, in my opinion, and mischievously inclined, politically inclined Orientalists who have argued exactly that, that the world of Islam is basically a medieval world, that it is a world that resents modernity and, above all, the symbol of modernity, the United States, and so on and so forth. I mean, that's complete nonsense. In the first place, modernity in the sense of McDonald's and, you know, computers and airlines and shopping centers and malls, etc., has come to the entire world, certainly the Islamic world as well. And, you know, it's quite clear that on the level of culture, there is an exchange that goes on despite the ideologues who say that East is East and West is West on both sides. I mean, it's very difficult to distinguish between the everyday life of one over the other. But it is also the case that people in the Islamic world feel that they, for the most part, live in polities, in states, in countries, ruled by unpopular regimes, all of whom, without any exception that I can think of in one way or another, I of course, Iraq is an exception, but are supported by the United States. I mean, one mustn't forget, in the first place, that the Mujahideen, who preceded the Taliban, the previous incarnation of the Taliban, were supported by the United States as fighters on the side of Islam against the godless communists in the Soviet Union in the 1980s. And when their leaders came to Washington I'll never forget this as long as I live, these bearded people, to my mind, being a secular person from a part of the world that produces monotheistic religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, I was horrified that Reagan greeted these people as, in fact, the moral equivalent of the founding fathers. Of our founding fathers, you know. So it suited the United States to coddle these people, as it has all these years, the government of Saudi Arabia, because of its oil, not because of its enlightened policies. And many people in these countries, there is a healthy secular opposition. There's a women's movement, there's a human rights movement. So in all respects, I think one can find not only the elements, but the wide currents of modernity inside contemporary Islamic societies. The question is that they're engaged in a political struggle with people who want to take Islam back to some earlier state, just as in this country we have people who want to return. Well, we have Falwell and Robertson and all those hundreds of thousands, millions even, of fundamentalists, Christian fundamentalists in this country who want to return us to a puritanical and simpler society. So that's the war. It's not between Islam and the West. It's between ideas of the past that exist in the West and ideas of the past and of the correct tradition that exists in the Islamic world, indeed everywhere in the Jewish world. Look at the struggle within Israel between different interpretations of Judaism. So I would say it's really the struggle of interpretations and not the struggle between modernity, the modernity of the West and the success of America, which most people in the Arab world that I know find very attractive and somewhat at odds with America's behavior internationally as a major, as the only superpower on the one hand, and people who want to return society to an earlier, purer, less sinful state. I mean, it exists everywhere.
We're talking to Professor Edward Said, and we'll be back with him in a minute after we break for stations to identify themselves. Then we're going to Peshawar and Islamabad to talk about the humanitarian disaster that is brewing right now in Afghanistan. Up to 1 million Afghans face starvation as Bush officials plan to bomb them. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! in Exile's War and Peace Report. And if you're listening online at WBIX.org or later in the day at webactive.com, call your community radio station and encourage them to air the War and Peace Report from Democracy Now! in Exile, Ground Zero Radio. We're also broadcasting on Channel 34 of Manhattan Neighborhood Network, as well as on CUNY Radio that goes out throughout the boroughs of New York, and available on Free Speech TV, Channel 9415 of Dish Network, and any public access station, cable station, can run this program. So encourage your public access station to do that. Just call Free Speech TV in Boulder, Colorado, as we bring together in an unprecedented way community media, from public access to direct satellite to community radio to the internet and the indie media movement around this country. We're talking with Professor Edward Said, a Comparative Literature Institute professor at Columbia University, who has recently written a piece about the latest that has taken place in the United States, the terrorist attacks on Washington and New York, a piece called Collective Passion: Can the Voice of Rationality Be Heard Over the War Drums? This appeared in El Aram Weekly online, based in Cairo. You were just talking about understanding the Muslim and Arab world, and also comparing fundamentalisms, whether it's a Muslim fundamentalism or Christian or Jewish fundamentalism. Would you like to continue on that point?
Yes, I mean, I think the mix of religion with politics, and that I found rather chilling in some of the president's statements, is a very unhealthy one, because, you know, if you think you have the vision and you're in touch with the divine and that speaks through you, then, you know, there's virtually no stopping what you do. I mean, I think that's certainly true of Muslim fundamentalism. It's true of Christians and Jewish fundamentalists, and produces the most skewed and immoral and pathological, I think that's the right word for it, pathological politics. Whereas it would seem to me that as a great country, I mean, with enormous power, it would seem to me that the United States ought to be setting the standard for universalistic norms that apply across religions and across cultures, if you like, that should govern human behavior. There's no reason, for example, why a man who was responsible, like Sharon was, for the massacres of Sabra and Shatila should not be included in the war against terrorism, or why only Muslim terrorists are singled out, as of course in this case they should be. But you know, the idea is that there should be a universal norm, you know, set by the United Nations, obviously, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, by which human behavior, state behavior, is governed, and not these religious justifications with which you can't argue. I mean, if you are possessed of the truth, there's nothing that can be said to you, and that's clearly the mindset of people who believe that God has given them X land and that they should take it and drive out these you know, inferior others who happen to be there, this sort of thing. So I think monotheistic fundamentalism is really the same across the board, and if we want to single out one, we ought really to include in that, not invidiously, but we ought to include inclusively all the others as well.
Professor Saeed, Ariel Sharon, the Israeli Prime Minister, is going to meet with Britain's Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw,
yes,
following a 15-minute phone call between Sharon and the Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Yes.
Sharon had earlier called off the meeting because of remarks Straw made in an article in an Iranian newspaper. The passage which caused offense said, "One of the factors that helps breed terror is the anger that many people in the region feel at events over the years in the Palestinian territories." Well, Downing Street said the phone call took place this morning at the request of Sharon.
Yes.
Straw is visiting Tehran as part of a U.S.-British effort to form an international coalition that would include Iran. What do you think of this latest, what Straw said, and also the meeting with Sharon?
Well, I think Straw, for the first time, you know, a British official at a high level, that told the truth. I mean, there's no question. There's absolutely no question in the Arab. Don't forget, we live in the age of television and satellite television, which has brought the Arab world together to watch the daily sufferings of Palestinians during the Intifada. I mean, in my opinion, having been there and watching it now from a distance, there's no question that Israel's behavior includes the worst collective punishment that ought to qualify for terrorism, state terrorism, imaginable. I mean, the idea of locking people in their homes, making it impossible for them to travel, demolishing their houses, taking their land, but uprooting, you know, they've uprooted 200,000 trees. I mean, that's sheer sadistic cruelty, to say nothing of endless killings and target, what they call targeted killings, which are, in fact, assassination of political leaders. I mean, you know, and the settlements go on, and the humiliation of Palestinians at the checkpoints where they can't move without going through Israel. I mean, this has been a fantastically galvanizing, I would even say polarizing, awareness amongst Arabs everywhere who watch this every day, powerless to do anything about it, and with the United States more or less continually supplying Israel with arms. I mean, that of course doesn't in any way justify horrendous acts, heinous acts of criminal violence, senseless, you know, destructiveness of the kind that hit our city. But it goes a long way to explaining a mood in which, you know, the United States and Israel are perceived as malevolent and not the kind of pure and innocent creatures that perhaps they want to pretend they are. So I think what I'm really pleading for is a kind of secular, open, and rational understanding of human behavior, and not to condemn it to the realms of the supernatural and say this is, you know, evil. We don't, you know, it comes from the devil. And all. No. These are human beings who are acting in unacceptable ways. There are degrees one ought to be able to analyze without, of course, condoning. One ought to be able to explain, and at the same time make judgments. But I think unless one does that, uses one's mind and tries to get past the collective passion, whether it's in the Arab world, in the Islamic world, against the United States, or in our country, against, you know, just wanting to go to war without some understanding of what the ground is like. I don't mean just the geography, but the moral and political and historical ground is like in the minds of others. We live in one world. We don't live in 27 different worlds. And once you know, this campaign is over, we'll have to go back to a world very much altered, in which I think the exchange between peoples becomes, I think, paramount.
And what do you think of bringing Iran into the coalition?
Well, I doubt that Iran will be in the coalition. It's in, properly speaking, I think the Iranians are, you know, who are the sworn enemies of the Taliban. You know, there's no love lost at all between them. You know, every country acts according to its interests, and Tehran is not, you know, quite in the same position of being pressured as Saudi Arabia and the Emirates are, who have in fact been supporting these Taliban and the Mujahideen originally because the U.S. made them do it. But there are lots of private contributions from these countries to Afghanistan. The Iranians, I think, are in quite a different position, and they may think of this as a way of perhaps improving their position with the United States, but I think entirely on their terms. I don't think there'll be any military action from Iran. I think there will be an attempt to somehow soften the atmosphere and make possible a normal relationship.
The House of Representatives voted yesterday to release $500 million that the United States owes in back dues to the United Nations, ending a long-running squabble at a time when the Bush administration says international cooperation is needed.
Yes.
What do you make of this, right?
Well, I mean, it's obviously too little, too late. I mean, I'm glad they did it, but we still owe, the United States still owes at least another billion in back dues to the UN. You know, some members of the Senate and House have made no secret of their contempt for the United Nations, and they feel, as I suppose many Americans, but not all, feel that, you know, the United States should go it alone, and why should we be bound by protocols that bind the rest of humanity? Well, you know, maybe this is the beginning of a change, and certainly the efforts on the part of the Bush administration to make this a coalition, to give it some kind of international, perhaps even United Nations legitimacy, is a sign that we're beginning to understand this, that even with our great power and the distance we are from the rest of the world, we're not invulnerable, and we suffer as much as we will and can suffer as much as anyone, and have suffered in the case of this terrible atrocity of September the 11th. But I think there is no hope, in my opinion, for the human community unless we rest our faith, I think, in communal organizations, of which the only universal one is the United Nations, and that we should be bound by the declarations and resolutions, which in many ways we ourselves have formulated. But, I mean, the behavior of the United States in the United Nations has also been scandalous. Promiscuous use of the veto whenever something goes against whenever, for example, Israel is criticized. You know, to use the United Nations as we did in the case of Iraq to enter this long period of just slow genocidal torture of the Iraqi people, in which, you know, 500,000 children have died needlessly. Those show in the end, I think, a kind of contempt for the rest of the world that ill suits us as a great power with I think an extremely compassionate population. I think most Americans are given a chance, and I think the media has not been good about this, but given a chance, will try to understand what the U.S. means in the world and what has been done in its name abroad, and that most Americans are open to the sufferings and miseries of others. I must stop.
Finally, Saddam Hussein, where this puts Iraq. You have people like Paul Wolfowitz pushing for the bombing of Iraq. Where do you think Iraq will fit in here? and the vision that you have of what actually is going to happen, since that has not been made very clear at this point, how the U.S. will conduct this so-called war.
Well, I think there's been a, you know, there's been a profound misunderstanding of what Iraq represents in the Arab world. I don't think there's much love lost amongst Arabs for Saddam, for his regime, which is known to be cruel and murderous. And I don't know many people who were in favor of his annexation and invasion of Kuwait in 1990. But you know, it's one thing to be opposed to Saddam and another to want to destroy the country even further. I mean, that seems to me to be sadism. And, you know, there was an opportunity, as no one is tired of remembering or repeating, during the war to enter Baghdad. And if that was the goal, you know, to get rid of him, that way, rather than to starve the Iraqi people. I think there is a struggle going on inside the administration as to what to do about Iraq, who to people, I think, like Wolfowitz, seems to be important only because it might be at one point a threat to Israel. I see that. I mean, Iraq is, by any standard, is not a threat to anyone now. I mean, Saddam obviously is, but the country has been, you know, its infrastructure is destroyed. Its people are in terrible shape after years of this of these sanctions. So I think wanting to destroy Iraq yet again seems to me just gratuitous violence and cruelty for no particular reason. And I doubt that it will occur, but I may be wrong.
Professor Sayed, I want to say thank you very much for being with us, and I hope you are feeling well. Professor Sayed is an Institute Professor of Comparative Literature at Columbia University, author of many books, among them Orientalism and his memoir, Time Out of Place. You are listening to Democracy Now in Exile's War and Peace Report. In our second hour, as we continue our two-hour daily specials, we are going to take on the issue of the Bush administration trying to lift all restrictions on arms sales, undoing decades of work by arms control and human rights groups. We also are going to hear about a struggle of a local firehouse in Brooklyn. More than half of the people in that firehouse, the firemen and women, were killed in the World Trade Center bombing, and then the city tried to close the firehouse. But last night, the people won. And we'll go there and also hear from Congressmember Major Owens. But right now, after the break, we turn to Peshawar and Islamabad in Pakistan to find out about the human catastrophe that is unfolding in Afghanistan, with close to a million Afghans facing starvation. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report. I am Amy Goodman. In our next hour, we're also going to look at the media, and we're joined by Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who can just give us a glimpse of what you are focusing on now.
Well, the sorts of things you're talking about on this show, Amy, are unfortunately the sorts of things we're not hearing in the mainstream media at large. The first casualty of war is the truth. We remember that. That was from California Senator Hiram Johnson in 1917 at the onset of World War I. The Washington Times updated that quote for their page one headline on September 17th, which read, "Wartime presidential powers supersede liberties. Censorship, martial law, allowed." So we're going to talk about some of the restrictions that are going to be placed on the media. They're announced. They're saying they're going to do it. They're saying we're going to lie to reporters.
And we're going to talk about that in our second hour. But right now, we go to Peshawar. The United Nations has launched an unprecedented operation to prepare for a massive crisis in Afghanistan as people scramble to escape feared U.S.-led military attacks. UN High Commissioner for Refugees spokesperson Peter Kessler told reporters yesterday that an emergency contingency operation in neighboring Pakistan is the biggest in the agency's history. We turn now to Gordon Weiss of UNICEF in Islamabad. Welcome to the War and Peace Report.
Thank you very much.
Can you tell us what is unfolding? What don't Americans understand about what's happening up to a million Afghans?
Well, what is unfolding is what has been unfolding for the past 3 years. We're at the culminating point, I suppose, of 3 years of severe drought. We have unknown numbers of people moving inside the country. I say unknown because we can't really formulate a clear picture of what's happening. Since our communications links with national staff inside Afghanistan have been cut, and journalists and aid workers outside Afghanistan can't get inside to form a clear picture. But what we can guess is that people who have already been suffering from drought this summer, a very terrible drought that has depopulated villages, are on the move with the additional problem of fear of military intervention.
There is very little understanding, certainly before what has developed over the last 2 weeks of Afghanistan. Can you talk about why it is that the people face starvation?
Well, there's been no water in Central Asia for the last 3 years, so they can't water crops, and of course that becomes chronic. It means that their orchards, their fruit trees are basically dying now, shriveling and dying. So there's really long-term damage and long-term famine conditions being created. And of course, you know, Afghanistan has been seen for years as being a bit of a basket case. So UNICEF, for example, had to borrow $5 million using an internal UN instrument just to be able to prepare for this winter in Afghanistan. And we're talking about numbers of recipients, aid recipients of Afghanistan, in Afghanistan, in the region of 5.5 million people.
We're talking to Gordon Weiss. He's speaking to us in Islamabad. We're also going to try right now to go to Peshawar, where Yusuf Hassan is standing by. He is just coming out of a major news conference of hundreds of reporters, UN High Commissioner for Refugees for Afghanistan. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile.
Jamal Ismail.
Hello, are you with us?
I'm just going to finish a call and I'll be with you. I'm on a call. I just finished.
Yusuf Hassan?
Got the call. Hello?
Yusuf Hassan, can you hear us?
I'll be back in a minute. Yes, I can hear you.
Can you tell us what you just spoke about at your news conference?
Well, we are just preparing on the ground for a major influx from Afghanistan. And we are working with the government of Pakistan, non-governmental organization, and other UN agencies to be able to be ready in case there's a major influx into the neighboring countries. And at the moment, we do expect the conditions in Afghanistan to deteriorate because of the long-running conflict as well as the drought. And the thousands and thousands of people who have been on the move out of the cities into the rural areas because of fear of attacks in the past few days.
What needs to be done right now?
Well, we're expecting up to 1.5 million people to flee Afghanistan into the neighboring countries. So what we need is a large amounts of food, tents, blankets, soap, and other material assistance that would be required by people who are famished, exhausted, and hungry, and who are going to come into neighboring countries with nothing at all.
Yusuf Hassan, I just want to
need all the assistance.
Yusuf Hassan, if I just want to ask of Gordon Weiss, if there's a TV there in the background, if you could turn it down, because we're having a hard time hearing.
Yeah, look, I'm standing in the lobby, unfortunately, so there are people around.
If you could cover your hand, if you could put your hand over the speaker then when you're not talking.
How's
so
that?
We can, thank you very much. Go ahead, Yusuf Hassan.
Well, all kinds of assistance would be required because this would be a massive displacement if it takes place. We already know that huge numbers of people are on the move, and therefore... And the countries that they're coming into, Pakistan and Iran, simply do not have the capacity to cope with such large number of people. And this is why there is a very urgent need for the donor community, the international community, to be able to rise to the assistance of these victims of the Afghan situation.
Are people expressing fear of being bombed?
Well, certainly the reason why people are getting away from the cities and into the countryside and into the neighboring countries are obviously a fear that something is going to happen. They have been listening to the radio stations, particularly to the BBC that broadcast to Afghanistan, and they know that something is going to happen, but nobody knows to what extent and where it may be happening. All they're doing is taking their families and their children to safer places. And there's no other place to look for most of them other than into the neighboring countries.
Right now, UNICEF, as well as United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, you've pulled your aid workers out of Afghanistan. Is that right?
Yes, all the UN agencies have had to withdraw their staff, international staff, from Afghanistan because of the security situation. They have been withdrawn to neighboring Pakistan, where they are in Islamabad.
I want to ask this question to both of you. Yusuf Hassan, who is with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees for Afghanistan, speaking from Peshawar, and Gordon Weiss with UNICEF in Islamabad. There is almost no coverage of this in the United States. What would you say to the U.S. government? Let's start with Gordon Weiss in Islamabad.
Well, it's difficult to send a message to the United States. The United States has actually been a generous donor to Afghanistan, and a large amount of the aid, for example, that was instrumental in enabling us and WHO, the World Health Organization, to begin immunizing up to 5 million children this last weekend. A large proportion of that donation came from the United States. It's not surprising that the grief and terror being felt by Afghanis is being ignored in the wake of the bombings in Washington and New York. But, you know, given time, people will understand that this is not just a military exercise, that the lives of 20 million Afghanis hang in the balance here. And we're just going to have to wait for that to happen. We're just going to have to wait for people to see the unfolding tragedy.
How are you getting food and other aid to people inside Afghanistan?
Well, we have supplies inside Afghanistan which have been pre-positioned, supplies that we pre-positioned prior to the 11th of September. And our national staff inside Afghanistan are still distributing those supplies. The thing is that in common with the World Food Programme, those pre-positioned supplies are rapidly dwindling. You know, we work on the basis that we move supplies into the country on a constant basis. Now, the borders are closed. We can't get anything into the country. We can barely get any information out of the country. So what we're doing and what the agencies are planning for at the moment is we're planning for cross-border operations. We're working on the presumption
at the moment as one of our contingency plans, that large numbers of people will move towards the borders, and if we can't actually penetrate Afghanistan for whatever reason, let's say there's large-scale military activity going on there, at least we will be able to reach these people. So to that end, UNICEF at least has got 6 flights leaving Denmark this week, loaded with medical equipment, water supply equipment, rehydration salts for children with diarrheal diseases. And we're positioning those in countries like Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Iran, and Pakistan, and moving them up to border positions so that we will be able to reach people more easily from those positions.
And Yusuf Hassan, from your position in Peshawar right now, we understand that the Taliban have confiscated UN supplies in Afghanistan. Is that true?
Well, I am in the Pakistan side of the situation here. I am not in contact, or our organization is not in contact with any of the offices that we have in Afghanistan. Not much information is coming from there. All I can tell you is what is happening on this side, in which there's a lot of anticipation and concern about the plight of many of the people who are trapped in between the major cities where they have left and the border areas, and who are massing up in some of the border areas but are unable to come in because the borders are closed. This is the biggest concern of people here, and that is what everyone here is focusing on in trying to see that we are ready. When it happens, that when they are about to come out, that we ensure that we would lessen their suffering and we'd be able to help them when we can. Those people who are in need of attention and assistance can receive that assistance once they arrive here in Pakistan or in neighboring Iran.
What is the Pakistani government saying? Why they're not allowing people into Pakistan? Well, they've closed the borders and then sometimes open them.
Well, all indications are that the Pakistani government is, in fact, anticipating an influx. They are working with us in preparing the ground. They have already suggested the sites and the places where these people could be located once they come out. But one could say that they already host one of the largest refugee populations in the world. Pakistan hosts 2 million people. And this is an enormous burden on their economy, on their country, and on their environment. And this is understandable given the fact that there isn't really much assistance coming in to support the Afghan refugees who are already here. That's why we are assuring them that there would be more attention and more assistance coming in for those people who would be allowed. And I think they are convinced that it is necessary at one time or another in the very near future that they would be in a position to open their doors for people who need urgent assistance.
Gordon Weiss in Islamabad, what about the children?
Well, the children, the women and children are the population at most risk at the moment in Afghanistan. We know that 2 weeks ago there were alarming levels of acute malnutrition, of acute respiratory diseases, of acute diarrheal diseases. If you add to that exposure undergone by children and women who are moving from area to area within Afghanistan, looking for food, looking for shelter, and you take into account the fact that there has already been 3 years of drought in the country, you're looking at terribly weak, frightened people, and the first among those are the children. Afghanistan already suffers with a child population with 50% malnutrition. I mean, 50% of all the kids in Afghanistan are malnutritioned in some form. One in every 4 children under the age of 5 dies before they reach 5. There is a mother, a young mother, dying every 15 minutes after giving birth to children. I mean, the statistics are just horrendous. So you add to that the sort of borderline stresses of the types of things happening in Afghanistan now, the doubt and the lack of aid, because this is a country that has been living on aid for 20 years. You cut that lifeline all of a sudden, and it only takes a matter of weeks. As it is, we're looking at a 6-week window in which we will be able to ship supplies in to protect the Afghan population before winter sets in. Now let's just stop and imagine what's going to be happening in those in those next 6 weeks, and you can understand how precarious the situation is for women and children, particularly.
How much money is needed right now? Not to mention the action that you feel has to be taken. I mean, if the U.S. said they weren't going to bomb Afghanistan, would that alleviate the situation?
Yes, of course it would alleviate the situation. I mean, a lot of the responses taking place inside of Afghanistan because the authorities there are acting as a country under siege. That's basically why our communications with national staff were cut several days ago. They didn't want us sending any form of information outside the country. That's not difficult to understand. In terms of money, you're already talking about tens of millions of dollars. That's money that we had budgeted just to protect the country this next winter. UN agencies are busy putting together their appeals on the basis of whatever planning we can actually make at the moment. But it's extremely difficult for us to plan. Just as media organizations can't anticipate what's going to happen, exactly the same thing applies to aid agencies. We're working on contingencies. We're working on trying to imagine the number of things that might happen in the next few months.
Well, Gordon Weiss, I want to thank you very much for joining us now in Islamabad, Pakistan, representing UNICEF. Yusuf Hassan on the phone with us from Peshawar, Pakistan, with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. He is the area coordinator from Afghanistan. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to write to us, send us email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. We have many people to thank for this unprecedented collaboration between television, radio, and the internet community broadcasters. Democracy Now in Exile is produced by Chris Abrams, Brad Simpson, and Miranda Kennedy. Anthony Sloan, our music maestro and engineer. Errol Maitland at the helm at WBIX.org. You can also hear us at webactive.com. Special thanks to Chase Pearson, Tony Riddle, Rick Youngers, Karen Renucci, Dee Dee Halleck, Tom Poole, Lenny Charles, and our hosts here at Downtown Community Television, John Alpert and Keiko Suno. Also to Lizzie Ratner, Sam Delgado, and Orlando Richards, our camera people. And thank you to Pacifica stations, especially KPFA and Pacifica affiliate KFCF in Fresno, all our affiliates around the country. We are Pacifica, broadcasting from the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown, in the evacuation zone in exile, from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the band, and the fired from the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Stay with us for our second hour.
I just went on and told her. She asked me why. I just went on and told her.